Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from Edvest and You, a loan product of the NEEF Network, a local nonprofit agency providing college student loans and student loan refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown, in for Laura Canoy. It was Milton Friedman who said, "Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around." When the coronavirus emptied city streets of commuters, the idea that was lying around was a radical one. What if we banned cars from downtown? It's an idea that's being tested in major cities all over the world. Oslo banned cars from its city center last year. Madrid banned older cars from their center. Paris bans cars from the urban core the first Sunday of every month. Even here in New Hampshire, fear of the virus has led to the restructuring of some public spaces. Hampton Beach has closed Ocean Boulevard to cars to make sure that everyone has their 6 feet of space, and some business owners in Hanover have called for excluding cars from South Main Street to draw in pedestrians. So today, as part of NHPR's new climate reporting project, By Degrees, we're unpacking this idea. We'll start the hour with a conversation I had last week with New York Times opinion columnist Farhad Manju. Manju recently wrote about a plan to ban large amounts of vehicle traffic from Lower Manhattan in an article titled, "I've Seen the Future Without Cars and It's Amazing." To see it, you can Google that headline or find a link to the piece on our website, nhpr.org. And later in the show, we'll hear from you. Are there places in our cities that cars shouldn't go? What would an idea like this look like in the smaller cities and towns like the ones that we have here in New Hampshire? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. But for now, my earlier conversation with Farhad Manju. So Farhad, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Now, you're a tech columnist. You're a self-described gearhead. And until recently, anyway, you describe yourself as a car lover with a red hot hatch,
yeah,
which is a term that's new to me, but essentially sort of like a very fast Volkswagen Golf.
Pretty much, yeah.
So how is it that you found yourself in a place where you were writing glowingly about plans or proposals to ban private cars from Manhattan?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this for some time, for at least the last couple years, which, and it sort of grew. I started noticing it because I would go around, my city, the sort of big city near where I live, which is San Francisco, but kind of all across the Bay Area, or anytime I went to New York, and it just began to strike me as really crazy that, you know, people would get annoyed by scooters or people would get annoyed by bikes when it was clear that, like, cars were taking up most of the road space. Yeah. And then I've been covering kind of how Silicon Valley has tried to kind of reinvent the car. And, you know, I just started to notice that all of those kind of answers to the problems of cars, those answers weren't really kind of solving the real problem, which is kind of the amount of space cars waste in cities.
So before we get too far, can we just define what we're talking about here? So this proposal, first of all, can you tell us about the proposal itself? And we should say right at the outset, this is not talking about completely banning automobiles from the city center. You'd still have delivery trucks and emergency vehicles and public works vehicles and paratransit, which is a term that was new to me. But this is vehicles for people who are not able to walk or bike or use the bus system.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the plan.
Yeah, so this is a plan was created by sort of former urban planning officials in New York, specifically this guy named Vishan Chakrabarty. And he and his team kind of created this plan for banning private automobiles in Manhattan. So this would be, you know, just a car that an ordinary person has, but, you know, commercial vehicles for deliveries would be, you know, allowed, paratransit, as you said, and kind of other vehicles, like emergency vehicles, other vehicles that kind of need to be there. But, you know, the overwhelming number of cars in Manhattan and, you know, anywhere else is usually, private automobiles. So this would get rid of kind of the majority of the cars in on the island.
And the centerpiece of this whole plan, it seems to me anyway, is sort of buses,
right.
Like more, better, faster buses.
Yeah. So in, you know, and Manhattan has been kind of leading the country in kind of blocking off areas of its space for uses other than cars. And in places around the island, most recently on 14th Street, they have banned cars on a lot of it, and that resulted in much, much faster bus service. And so this sort of suggests that if you, and, you know, traffic engineers kind of looked at this plan, if you get rid of private automobiles in Manhattan and instead kind of have, you know, dedicated bus lanes and a way for people to get on and off the buses very quickly, so like a platform in the center, you get something called bus rapid transit, which is, you know, a way of getting around a city that is like as fast and kind of efficient as subways, as kind of underground areas, but much cheaper to set up because you're using existing road space. And, you know, a lot of cities around the world have this sort of bus rapid transit system. And if you get rid of cars, those buses can go very fast. So, you know, we're talking about kind of a, like something like a 60% reduction in traffic. And so you start to get a bus system that like matches the subway in terms of like its throughput.
It's funny. I remember when the 14th Street bus first debuted and there was just, like, social media was just full of these like giddy videos that people had taken of just like zipping by traffic from the bus window.
Yeah. And if you, you know, if you walk in that area, you kind of go downtown, you get to 14th Street and it feels like it's in a different part of the world, right? Because you can't, like, it's quieter. I feel like maybe this is just like a placebo, but I feel like it smells better. You don't like there's not like the constant din of traffic that people are used to, and it's safer. Like there's no, you can kind of cross more easily. I think all of this stuff kind of, people kind of underestimate the kind of livability gains from cars and from cars going away. And I think one of the things we wanted to show in this project was like all the ways just regular, ordinary daily life would be, how much better it would be if we didn't have the cars there.
And I really would like to encourage everybody who's listening to go and look at the piece itself, because it's presented in this very compelling visual way that's hard to convey on the radio. And I think probably the easiest thing to do is just Google the headline, which is, "I've seen the future without cars, and it's amazing." But banning cars would mean suddenly we'd have all of this space. What can we use that space for apart from buses?
Pretty much every other form of transportation. So, you know, sidewalks would get wider, so there'd be a lot more pedestrian space. There would be kind of a dedicated bike lanes that are protected from cars. So, you know, protected with a curb. So you would imagine you'd get regular bicycles on there, but also e-bikes, which are, you know, becoming very popular. These are electric motor assisted bicycles that, you know, can get you far distances or up hills without a lot of effort. And then, you know, there's things like scooters, kind of various other little micro mobility devices that are becoming very popular in many parts of the world. All these kinds of, you know, new forms of transportation. And then pretty much like all the roads would also be safer. So you could imagine, you know, lots of people are thinking of kind of new ways of ferrying people around. You could perhaps get like small, like micro buses for, you know, faster, like closer transportation, kind of all ways you can imagine of like repurposing some larger vehicles. I think you could have those too.
One of my favorite images from the story is Park Avenue, you know, back in the day when it was named because it had a park down the middle. And now that park has been sort of reduced to just this tiny median, this like planter in the median strip.
Right, right.
And in this report, it's once again reimagined as an actual sort of promenade with a park.
Yeah. And you would get those kinds of, you know, wonderful places to walk or ride a bike kind of everywhere on the island. You know, right now, like one side of Manhattan is kind of blocked off from the water. You don't really see it because there's roads there. Now you would have bike lanes and pedestrian promenades there. Even across kind of all of the bridges coming into the island, you would have places for people to bike and walk. There would be kind of walking promenades across the bridges. And you'd have dedicated bus lanes on the bridges. So there would be, you know, room for cars, for things like Ubers, but it would be far less room and you could use it for, you know, all other means of transportation.
One of the kind of boggling statistics about Manhattan traffic that I learned from your article is that cars today, the average speed is often not much faster than walking.
Yeah, it's you know, the thing about cars is they when there are a lot of them, they just don't function very well. And so there are just too many cars for the amount of space there is on the island. And so they've been, you know, they keep getting slower and slower and kind of getting in the way of more people. I mean, they're also kind of lots of, they also hit a lot of bicyclists. But yeah, they're very, like in Midtown, the kind of average speed of traffic is 5 miles per hour, which is right, just slightly faster than walking.
This is like kind of a silly comment, but another one of the images that you all showed that was really remarkable to me was a picture of a city street today that was dominated by parking and just like big pile of trash.
Right.
Because like, what do you do when you're in such a tight city with all this trash? And then the second shot was essentially the parking was gone. There were many more people out on the sidewalk because the sidewalk was wider, and there was just like an aesthetically pleasing trash container instead of a pile of bags.
Yeah.
And it was just like amazing how something so small made such a big difference.
Yeah. I mean, if you go into cities around the world, like cities as big as New York, it's not like common to see piles of garbage on the street. And that's because they have like proper garbage receptacles and ways for, like vehicles, trash trucks to pick them up. Side spaces of streets is taken up by parked cars. Like that parking, the amount of parking space, street parking space in Manhattan is something like the size of Central Park. Like it's a lot of space that you could use for things like these livability improvements, like proper receptacles for garbage. You can use it for, just like more pedestrian space, just more space for people to walk.
So part of the argument here is also that this can actually be beneficial for drivers as well. So can you say a bit more about how that works?
Yeah, so one thing that happens when you ban cars from Manhattan is, because Manhattan is kind of the central hub of kind of all New York commuting, like everyone kind of around the area is coming into Manhattan every day. If you make the bridges and tunnels and kind of the way into Manhattan much faster without cars, then you actually improve traffic in the rest of the city, even places where cars are still allowed. So, you know, this study found that, in Brooklyn, in the Bronx, like if you started trips from, you know, one part of the outer boroughs to another, you would get, traffic gains of like 20% just by banning the cars coming into Manhattan. And the other thing you get around the city is like a far lower concentration of like toxic pollutants in the air. So a lot of the kind of areas in New York that have the worst air, the worst air pollution, they're on the outer parts of the city on the kind of clogged highways coming into Manhattan. And so if you get rid of kind of all of the idling cars around that are coming into the city, you get, you know, a huge reduction in air pollution, which kills thousands of people a year in New York City.
So this piece was really laser focused on New York City, Manhattan specifically, I'd say. And I guess one of the things that I'd like to ask is that New York City is pretty unique in the American context. Like there's only a handful of cities with populations bigger than a million. Mm-hmm. And here in New Hampshire, we have just one city that has a population even higher than 100,000, which is, you know, Manchester, the Queen City.
Yeah.
And so I guess what I'm wondering is what does a state like New Hampshire, what can we take from this type of sort of blue sky report that was written for a place like New York City?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things for people who think about kind of the end of cars or a time to like look forward to a time with fewer cars, I think you kind of have to start in like the most dense and most and the largest cities. And the idea is that it kind of you know, kind of spreads out from there. Like, one of the things that could happen if you ban traffic cars from Manhattan is, you know, people who live in, like, Connecticut and commute in may need fewer cars, and that may, you know, kind of prompt those areas to become less car dependent. I think in, you know, a lot of kind of less densely populated and smaller places, it could be more difficult to ban cars and to not kind of live or to live without cars. But like in all these places, we are seeing some, kind of more local alternatives to cars, you know, as I said, e-bikes and things like that. And you know, in a place that's small, an e-bike might be like a perfectly, you know, acceptable alternative for like, you know, 50% or maybe even like 80% of your trips. I went to college in Ithaca, New York, which is, you know, not tiny, but like, you know, a much smaller place than most of other cities I lived in. And I think that if you had an e-bike, there's lots of hills there and, you know, it's a little bit spread out. But if you had an e-bike, it would be much more convenient than having a car there, because like in small cities, there, you know, parking is also difficult. And, you know, just as in other cities. So like you still like get gains in livability, even in places where, you know, there aren't a lot of people or a lot of, you know, or it's not that dense.
Well, and also I'm reminded of places like Burlington, Vermont, that took a single street, Church Street, and pedestrianized it, you know, booted all the cars out. Mm-hmm. And that Church Street, you know, especially locals, I think, are sort of annoyed by the way that chain stores sort of moved in and took up a lot of the storefront on that street. But still, it's packed mm-hmm. with people every day. And I'm wondering if what a version of this is in terms of starting small, if you're a small town or a small city, is just that, like one street, Main Street, and close it to non-essential cars.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of places are sort of going to be experimenting with that. And, you know, many of the studies I've seen have suggested that, you know, pedestrianizing streets leads to an increase in foot traffic, which then like is good for the businesses around there. A lot of times small businesses are worried that if they don't have parking, like it'll be difficult to come there. But often when you kind of pedestrianize a space, it becomes a place that's popular because people want to hang out there and like they don't have to worry about the cars hitting them. You know, I think that with the pandemic, a lot of places have kind of been forced to do that. There wasn't a lot of space. Now a lot of places are turning streets over to like outdoor dining. And, you know, people may start to love that. And I suspect that a lot of those places, you know, who are doing that may make some of it like permanent even after the virus threat is over.
Well, and kind of along those lines, I wonder if you have any other thoughts about how this happens. And in particular, I'm thinking, so New York City was the first city in the United States to implement a congestion charge, which is basically this like very, you know, expensive toll on every single vehicle that would come into Manhattan. And it took like, you know, more than a decade of pressure.
Right.
And now it's had an extra year delay announced before it's actually implemented. So obviously it's hard, you know, the dominant culture is still car culture. And when so many Americans are drivers, who pushes for this?
It's a good question. I mean, I think that the car industry has been especially good at kind of adapting to the latest kind of challenges against it. I mean, the car industry has been a dominant industry in this country for 100 years, and kind of like there have been various kind of threats to its, you know, dominance over time, and they have kind of successfully navigated that. And the latest kind of idea is that, you know, in the future, cars will be substantially safer with autonomous technology, and that they will be much cleaner because they will be electric. And those ideas may work, but like I think that it's often better to kind of look at the kind of short-term impact of technologies. And right now, cars are just extremely damaging to the environment and to, you know, actual human lives. And And I don't think we often, you know, think about that enough. And like, I really wanted to try with this article, you know, a number of people have suggested banning cars, but I really wanted to try to show kind of the amazing kind of quality of life gains that you get with it. And I think that maybe that will be the thing that pushes people to do it. You know, like as they see places like Manhattan or like parts of big cities like San Francisco, and even in small places where they've pedestrianized, you know, areas and they've become really popular. I think as people see the gains from that, we might start to notice kind of some ability to go with fewer cars. Like I live in the suburbs in the Bay Area in a place where I definitely need a car for a lot of things, but I feel like with e-bikes or bicycles and like some other ways to get around just short distances, we could do with like one car instead of two for our family of four. We could kind of reduce our you know, our need to always use the car. And I think a lot of places will add those kind of incremental you know, car alternatives over time.
Yeah. It is interesting because, you know, here in New Hampshire, apart from sort of right up the main interstate that connects to all, you know, to Boston, on a Friday evening on a what's forecast to be a weekend with nice weather, there's not a ton of traffic to speak of, but the quality of life improvements that you're talking about, you know, would materialize whether or not traffic is a substantial problem in the downtowns of our small cities and small towns.
Yeah, I mean, traffic is a huge problem in many parts of the country. And so those gains would be, you know, would be incredible for a lot of people. But yeah, I mean, you get just like some in every part of the country, some number of people are killed kind of randomly by cars. You would get a reduction in that. And you get these like, you know, ability to I think what's interesting about it is like the way you feel a little bit freer and like less worried about cars hitting you when you're walking down a road. Mm-hmm. I noticed this like during, you know, during the quarantine when there were no cars on the street. My kids and I were able to just kind of like walk and think of the street as like not belonging to cars. And like when people get those get the feeling for that, I feel like we start to notice that like cars are not they're not the way that, you know, you see them in car commercials. They're often like deadly and kind of annoying. And maybe we can start to think beyond them.
All right. Farhad Banju, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Great. Thanks so much. I'm really glad to be here.
When we come back, what can places like New Hampshire learn from the ideas in Manju's piece? Can small towns and small cities realize the benefits, the cleaner air, the safer streets that limiting cars would provide? We want to hear from you. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Sam Evans Brown, filling in for Laura Kanoy. We just finished hearing from New York Times opinion columnist Farhad Manju about a vision of New York City with radically fewer cars. Now we're going to bring that conversation from the big city to small towns. Later in the show, we're going to talk with planners from two New Hampshire towns who are wrestling with some of these ideas. But on the line with us now is Norman Garrick, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. Professor Garrick, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, Sam. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the last segment.
So for starters, we've already gotten an email from Andrew in Hillsborough who says, really? Seriously? New Hampshire is very rural with uneven resource distribution, medical care, shopping options, etc., and completely inadequate public transportation systems, in quotation marks. New Hampshire is no Denmark or Singapore. So I guess I'd like to start with, is it just crazy to talk about an idea like this in a place like New Hampshire?
Well, on a lot of levels, it's not. I mean, in fact, New Hampshire has some really great cities that are, I would say, are low-car cities. You look at Dartmouth and, to some extent, Portsmouth. Portsmouth,
Right. And so that what you're saying there is that this isn't about the state as a whole, but really about the urban centers in a few of the spots around the state.
It's about the urban centers to start with, but it's also about some of the smaller, more historical villages and how you maintain the character in those places.
Right. So maybe you could like paint a picture here of how some of these ideas, which I think in Manju's piece were really specific to New York City, how some of them might look sort of scaled differently to different communities like the ones that we've talked about already, Portsmouth, Hanover, or some of these small historic town centers, like, say, the center of Amherst, New Hampshire.
How the amount of parking and how we manage parking. And the second thing is how the streets are designed. Are they designed for traveling at 30, 40, 50, or are they designed at a lower speed, which is much safer for people and foot? Those are the two things that would make a huge difference in these towns, cities, and villages.
So maybe we could touch on each of those individually. Tell me more about how our roads are designed in ways that encourage drivers to go faster than is safe.
Yes. So most roads in both rural and urban places in America are designed to accommodate relatively high speed. Drivers use the street. And so you start to see a different sense of what these places are for. You also see a reduction in speed, and it feels safer. It is safer for all users.
And then if we were to look at parking, how would parking be reformed in a way that would encourage more different users?
Almost every place in the country, New England, all over the country, provides way too much parking, and that's part of the zoning codes in these places. We did a study years ago, about 15 years ago. We looked at six small New England cities, and what we found was that even on the most progressive city, that at the busiest time of the year, no more than 80% of the parking was being used. On a regular day, in many places, less than 40% of the parking that is provided is being used. What makes the difference is, firstly, how much parking is provided, and secondly, how these centers manage parking. Do they charge for parking? Do they have individual parking for each businesses, or do they have parking that is shared throughout the downtown? So those are issues that really change. And one of the places we looked at was Brattleboro, Vermont, which has been really good compared to surrounding places in terms of how it manages parking, how much parking it provides, etc.
So Amy from Dover emails in and says, I live in Dover. I hate the loud, fast trucks that barrel through downtown. Give our cities back to pedestrians and they'll flourish to their full, vibrant potential. Cleaner air, quieter streets, happier residents. So Professor Garrick, you touched on Brattleboro. Can we talk about more places like that aren't New York City and have, you know, a million plus residents that are doing these types of things? And what do those cities look like? How are their main streets different from ones that were designed, you know, decades ago?
But actually, I think you're in Concord. That's correct?
That's correct.
Concord has a great main street.
Yeah, I tend to agree.
A few years ago, I would think maybe 10 years ago.
So this is actually really interesting. So I moved to Concord in 2011 and was here as the consideration of how to widen the sidewalks and redesign downtown was happening. And it's funny because I remember it as a very bitter fight. And many merchants downtown kept saying, you know, well, Concord isn't Burlington. Now you're right. Now that the project is completed, it's pretty popular.
I'm not surprised. That happens all over the world, all over the country, but all over the world. And you hear the same kind of language. One of the interesting interesting things people talk about. We are not Copenhagen. We are not Amsterdam. It's documented that when Copenhagen was changing its attitude towards cars, the exact same language was used. In that case, the language was, we are not Italy. We are not Mediterranean. So it's a fight that it goes on and on all over the place. And of course, yes, you can point to Concord Main Street. It's a wonderful Main Street.
So I guess I wonder if there are trends like the one that you just mentioned that you see coming up over and over again, where concerns are raised by communities that later sort of reveal themselves to be red herrings. But then also, are there trends in which there are real struggles that communities have over and over in terms of how to actually implement these types of changes?
Well, what is good about what we're seeing is that there are more places to point to. Being able to point to Concord Main Street, it helps the next town over. And then you might hear then that we're not Concord, but that's all right. At least people can drive to Concord and see and experience what is going on there. I think that is slowly starting to change the balance of the conversation, because more people are being exposed to these ideas. More people are seeing that it actually works to be not totally driven by car concerns. And they see what these changes can bring to the communities. So I think that's really helping.
So as a reminder to you, our listeners, the number to call in if you want to participate in the conversation is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email as well at exchange@nhpr.org, or of course, reach out to us with a comment or question on Facebook or Twitter. Professor Garrick, I'd really quickly like to touch on equity here, because I think, you know, certainly there are some folks around New Hampshire who don't have a car, period, and are walking or riding bikes because perhaps it's their only option. But there's also a lot of rural poverty here in New Hampshire, and that's folks who may be able to afford a car, but only just barely, and are maybe commuting a long distance from a town where they can afford housing into a town where they have a job. To what degree, given that reality, does restricting cars make life harder for some folks in a situation like that?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question that is very localized. And you really have to think through what you're trying to achieve when you're implementing policies. I did a project in Nantucket a few years ago. And one of the concerns that was raised was, what about all the workers? You know, we were trying to implement a charge for parking in the downtown. And one of the concerns raised was, well, what about the workers? In a situation like that, there are policies that you can make. You can, for example, give people a pass that they can park if they're a genuine worker or a resident or whatever the case is, depending on the particular situation. But what I find is that in a place like Nantucket, where most people are not poor, this is what's actually used as a red herring, as you said, to really not deal with the issues. We need to be thinking through how these different issues work, who they're going to benefit, who they're going to work, and craft policies that address the problems as well as try to get to some solutions. We cannot just throw up our hands and say that we can't do anything because of the potential impact on certain populations. We also have to look at the other side of the issue, where by being so car-centric, there are huge equity issues that raises also.
Now, we're going to keep you on the line here, Professor Garrick, but I'd like to bring in another voice to this conversation. Julie Griffin is the town manager of Hanover, where at least a few merchants have called for kicking cars off of South Main Street. Julia, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you very much, Sam.
So I'd like to know how long this idea of trying to remove some traffic from downtown in Hanover has been kicking around, and when did it get serious enough for it to be written up by the local newspaper and therefore for us here at The Exchange to notice it?
So, Sam, we have a bike walk committee of volunteers that work with our Public Works Department and our Planning and Zoning Department and all things bicycles and pedestrians. And ironically, the pandemic and the governor's decision to allow restaurants to move to outdoor dining precipitated some pretty rapid action on the part of town staff to enable our downtown South Main Street restaurants to move into parking spaces on South Main Street, which are typically highly coveted parking, mind you, when we're not in a pandemic era, so that these restaurants could serve outdoor guests while still enabling pedestrians to use the sidewalk. And we discovered what fun that has been for downtown Hanover. Obviously, the demand for parking has been somewhat reduced as people tend to be laying low. But for those who are venturing out and enjoying our downtown restaurants, they've really benefited from being outdoors, and certainly the restaurants have. And that led to a call from folks in the community to think about either completely closing South Main Street, which is problematic because it's State Route 10 in a heavily trafficked roadway, or at least permanently eliminating the on-street parking to enable us to refurbish our sidewalks and expand significantly the amount of space available to pedestrians, bicycles, and diners.
That's a really interesting story there, because there's this newish term that's been floating around in planning circles in recent years, which is tactical urbanism, which is this idea that you can deploy these like very low cost methods to change traffic patterns and show people what it might be like if you were to make a more permanent change. And one of my favorite examples of this are bike lanes or wider sidewalks that were created with like rows of potted plants. Or the funniest, I think, was actually a line of toilet plungers that was used to create a bike lane in Boston. So, and I guess my question is, you know, you alluded to it a little bit, but how has the community response been, apart from some who are clearly delighted?
Yeah, in general, the community response has been really positive. There is some alarm in two surrounding neighborhoods when the discussion turns to completely closing South Main Street, because our challenge in downtown Hanover, unlike downtown Burlington, for example, is that we don't have an alternate route to divert the 10,000 vehicles a day onto from one heavily used State Route 10 thoroughfare. So we've got a traffic challenge in a rural area where so many people have to rely on vehicles because of a lack of sort of widespread public transportation. But the notion of potentially eliminating the on-street parking or enabling pop-up dining during the summer months when outdoor dining is feasible, and then reconverting that space back to parking in the winter when it gets too chilly to eat outdoors, I think that has legs. And we're actually working with a traffic engineer now that works out of Boston to develop some options for us so that we can talk about floating a bond this time next year to do a complete overhaul of our downtown sidewalk and bicycle lane system. And quite frankly, Sam, I was just down in Cambridge this weekend. Cambridge is doing some very cool things around bike ped, and they've also cannibalized some through lanes to enable outdoor dining during this pandemic phase.
So, Professor Garrick, I'm curious your reaction hearing about this story in Hanover. Is this sort of, you know, Farhad Manju light, just taking a few parking spaces and perhaps making them flexible depending on the season?
Well, I'm not sure I would label it as light. I think, as I've mentioned before, I think the options that we want to try in different places depends on the specifics of the situation. And I think this is really great to be thinking about how you can reposition a street like that. It's what makes that particularly challenging, aside from anything else, is the fact that it's a state highway. That's really where towns and cities run into problems. They don't own those spaces, and the DOTs have a different interpretation of what their highway should be used for.
After a break, we will talk to another town administrator here in New Hampshire who is similarly trying some very low effort adjustments during the pandemic. We want to hear from you. Give us a call or email us exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
I don't win anything. That's not my thing.
I was shocked because I've never won anything in my life before.
I've never won anything before. That's terrific.
No one ever thinks they're going to win an HPR summer raffle until they do. And this year could be your year. Three early bird winners can choose between $2,000 in gas gift cards or EV charging. And our grand prize winner can choose between $25,000 toward a new car or $20,000 in cash. Get your raffle tickets right now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Sam Evans-Brown, filling in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, limiting cars in city centers. What would downtown look like if we weren't quite so worried about how to move automobiles through it? On the line with us is Norman Garrick, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. And joining us now is Nick Coates, town administrator from the town of Bristol. And I should disclose here, Nick, that you and I are friends. You used to work down here in Concord and organized a bike swap and a film festival that I helped out with. But happy to have you on The Exchange.
Well, I appreciate it. I remember the days back when we were working on that Concord project.
So remember, folks, we want to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. So Nick, what has Bristol done during the pandemic?
So, you know, the pandemic has kind of highlighted some things that we've done for the last 10 years as a town. And so one of the things that we've done as an extension to closing down some roads in our downtown, we've now repurposed the sidewalk space for public for seating for restaurant and some small public garden type space. And it started out as just the outside seating mandate coming with the outside seating mandate. But we've extended it, and we're now extending it to at least Labor Day, and now starting to look at how we could potentially make that a permanent facet of our downtown.
So Pete emails recalling that when he was a GI Bill student in Grenoble, France, the downtown had been engineered to have cafes and shops and no cars for acres. Other European cities and towns have followed suit, and I have read that retail merchants at first tended to be wary, but eventually realized that it works great for them. Nick, I'm curious how your downtown merchants and other tenants in the downtown have reacted, and generally, how has it been whenever the subject of eliminating parking has been broached in a town like Bristol?
Well, you know, I mean, parking's at a premium in our downtown, and I've always tried to tell people that we want a parking problem. That means that our businesses are doing well, and we do have a parking problem. So like everything, like any change, people are always sort of reticent at the beginning. But what we found throughout this pandemic is that our businesses are, especially our downtown businesses, are thriving. We have lots of folks who have been coming to the downtown, stopping, parking. And we also have some really neat things that are happening now. Space is now being used for mini pop-up concerts that have been happening at the jazz club. And we're finding a whole new vibe to the downtown that we just unleashed with this. So I think a lot of people reticent at first and still obviously weary that parking's a little bit of a challenge. I think I've accepted it because they've realized that it's actually brought business and a new sort of energy to the downtown.
I guess one of the things I'm wondering, you know, Bristol was recently featured in the New York Times because a major manufacturer in town had cut a whole bunch of jobs. And similarly, we heard from Hanover that folks there, you know, were okay with eliminating parking because traffic was down a little bit during the pandemic generally. And so demand on parking was a little bit slack. So I guess, you know, do you see any connection between economic changes because of the pandemic and the willingness to try these experiments?
Well, I mean, I guess I'll take a step back. I mean, the thing that's interesting about Bristol is it's a small town, but it functions like a city in many ways when it comes to the downtown, because it is urbanized. It's an old mill town, so we really haven't seen a drop off in terms of that. What we also have been seeing is that, in fact, we probably have been more busy this year because we have a lake. Our community actually triples in size typically. Hmm. And what we found is people came up earlier and the business has been sustained through it. So while the manufacturing plants are slowed down operations for a little while, we have not seen a slowdown here. It's actually probably been just as busy, if not busier, which presents challenges, obviously, from a traffic management perspective.
We have Ryan on the line up in Whitefield. Ryan, welcome to the Exchange. What do you have to say?
Hi. I was just thinking that, you know, up here in the more rural areas of the state, you know, converting the old rail lines to rail trails would be an option.
Now, obviously, that's something, Nick, that you've been involved with in your bicycling advocacy. Any thoughts in terms of activity going on that front as repurposing those old rights of way?
Yeah, actually, so interestingly enough, so we have a grander vision, which is to basically connect our downtown to the lake by pedestrian and bicycle means. And we've started that with a rail trail already, and we actually just built a second phase of a rail trail that now goes from our downtown along the river and will eventually connect to downtown Franklin. So what you would be able to do is be able to go from downtown Franklin to the lake in Bristol via a rail trail or on-road facility such as a wider bike lane.
It's funny. I drove through Bristol not too long ago and was actually astounded by the bicycle traffic that I saw along the sort of eastern side of the lake. I wonder, Norman Garrick, you know, what you're hearing here from folks up in New Hampshire who are working on these issues. Is it typical from what you have seen in your travels about New England in working with communities of similar size?
Definitely. Rail to trail, that's a fairly easy way to start building a biking culture. So yes, a lot of these methodologies and changes that I'm hearing for Bristol sounds typical.
And I guess if that's a first step, how does that type of work get continued? What is the next obvious step after something like a rail trail, which is a right of way that's already created, already graded and flat, and just sort of needs a little bit of improving and paving?
Well, you also need to eventually get to working on the surface streets, because eventually, people have to be able to access the rail to trail. You don't want it to be just a recreational facility. Hmm. And you also don't want it to be connected to streets that poses a danger to bicyclists, which is what I would say the current situation in most places is that state highways, the way they're constructed, people going 40 miles per hour, that's not a really great environment for biking. Some cases, you might be able to get away, especially in more rural parts, you might be able to get away with a bike trail that is independent of the road but runs more or less following the right of way of the road. That has been one method that has been used in my hometown of Mansfield, Connecticut.
Nick, this is an interesting point because, as I said, I visited Bristol recently, and what I noticed is that rail trail continues for a little while, but then you're sort of plunked out into a very busy state highway that doesn't have, you know, the most appealing vibe for folks who are not in a car.
Yeah, so we actually have a plan for that. So as part of that downtown to the lake connection, we're actually in the middle of planning out a sewer extension project. And so what we're going to do when that sewer extension project happens is that we're going to work with the Department of Transportation to resurface that road in a way that's going to be a little bit better so that you're not plunked down. But then also looking at that as an opportunity to identify ways in which we can maybe put some off-road facilities or some sort of protected sections where it is the worst. So, you know, the biggest hurdle right now, as I think you guys talked about, is really the Department of Transportation and how they view transportation, what their role is and all that. So, you know, we've been very lucky so far. We've had a lot of good positive dialogues, and we're trying to be opportunistic. And so as opportunities show themselves, we try to jump on and improve those little things that really are big things for people. So, you know, little by little, we're trying to make some progress.
Let's go now to Dick in Gilmanton, who has something to say about all this idea, all these ideas. Dick, welcome to the Exchange.
Oh, thank you.
So what do you have to say? What do you think about what you've been hearing?
Well, it's a couple of things. One of the things when I heard about the parking study talking about excess parking in especially in New Hampshire cities, I'm not sure where this person went, but if you ever tried to get parking in Concord or Manchester, that's problematic, and I just don't see where there's excess parking. But my larger point was about people who have walking disabilities. You know, it's all well and good to talk about having car-free downtowns and things for people who can walk and move around and get on, you know, on bicycles and things. But people with walking disabilities are going to be left out of that equation.
So, Norman Garrick, I'd like to throw this question to you. Of course, cars, if you aren't able to walk very easily, are a great way to ferry you directly to the door of an establishment that you're trying to get to. How do you get around you know, that issue?
Well, as I've mentioned before, you plan for those kinds of things. There are exceptions that can be made for people that need to get to move door to door. There are different ways of doing it, including providing special spaces or special permits, or having a shuttle service, depending on the context. So it's one of those issues that you think about, and you try to come up with solutions that work for all people, not just for able-bodied people. You have raised the question of equity before, and it's looking at equity in a more holistic way, and including both sides of the equity equation.
Well, and I guess if part of the question here is part of the reason that it's so hard to find a parking spot is that there are lots of folks who don't necessarily need to park directly in front of the establishment that they're going to that are doing so.
And one thing I would say about parking is that everywhere I've worked, there is this sense that there is not enough parking. But once you start counting, once you start measuring, you find that this is not the case. And part of the problem is that there is this expectation that we should be able to drive up to wherever destination we want to be going to and stop right in front of that place. That's not going to happen anywhere, no care how small the city is or how large it is. It's not a realistic expectation. And so people are going to be disappointed in that way.
So Cammie in Milford writes, European cities are great for families because they're fenced-in areas with outdoor cafes inside. So parents can drink coffee with other adults while kids run around and play without the safety hazard of cars. Small towns in New Hampshire with village greens could fence areas on the green off and put a cafe inside. Robert asks, does the infrastructure invite people to bicycle on main streets and other streets? In many cases, people are too fearful as they to consider bicycling as for transportation. In Concord, the investment in car culture, parking, paving meters far outpaces investments to create safe and inviting spaces for those who are interested but concerned. So Norman, if you were to sort of reimagine a downtown in a place like let's talk about Concord because we had Robert commenting from Concord just a moment ago. Obviously, some changes have been made. What's the next step for a place like Concord?
Well, Concord is fascinating to me because it has this beautiful main street. It's a really lovely change. But if you go one block away from downtown, or a few blocks away from downtown, you basically are approaching what is, in essence, a highway. So you have, in the downtown, this little nugget of urbanism, and then going a block one way or a block in the other direction, you're approaching this suburban-like environment. And it seems to me that the two extremes just doesn't work together, and that's what I would start looking at, is how some of those surrounding streets and the extension of Main Street could become more urban-like, so that it's not just people driving or walking. We would encourage people to be able to walk to that nugget of a main street if the rest of downtown had the similar, not the same, but similar, more urban character.
All right. I want to thank all of our guests who are with us on the program today. That was Professor Norman Garrick from the University of Connecticut. We had Nick Coates, town administrator in Bristol, and Julia Griffin in Hanover, New Hampshire. The show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our regular theme music is composed by Bob Lord. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Thank you for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.